I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. That's the opening bell for the Nasdaq Stock Exchange in New York today. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, wearing his trademark hoodie, rang it via satellite from his company's offices in Menlo Park, California. Facebook is a publicly traded company as of today. That completes the social networking site's 8-year journey from a Harvard dorm room to Wall Street. But the public offering of Facebook stock comes as the market has been falling sharply due to fears over the health of U.S. banks after multi-billion dollar losses at J.P. Morgan Chase and fears over the stability of the European Monetary Union. Still, among those with interest in today's Facebook sale are the rocker Bono, whose investment could yield him more than $1 billion in profit, and the state of California, which stands to collect as much as $2.5 billion in taxes. With us now is Paul Sloan, executive editor with the technology news site CNET. Paul, earlier in the day, it seemed like some investors were defriending Facebook. Some news outlets were calling it a stock fizzle. How do you read it?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't get off to quite the large pop that people had come to expect, since there was just so much hype around it. And actually, there seemed to be some technical issues at the Nasdaq. But, you know, it's still trading up, and the company raised the price just a couple days ago, and Facebook just raised $16 billion. And by any measure, it's a huge, phenomenal success.
There are still, though, analysts who are divided over what the future of the company will be. You know, they point out that its revenues are a tenth of Google's revenues and that it's not clear where more revenue is coming from Facebook. Do you think those are fair worries?
Of course. It's a public company, and if you own the stock, you have a right to see value in it from the business itself. Look, it's now valued as much as Amazon. It's now half of Google and from a market value. It doesn't have anywhere near the business model yet. When people are investing in Facebook, they're investing in this huge opportunity that is not yet realized. Now, it's not a 1990s kind of bubble company. It makes money. It had $1 billion in revenue last quarter. It's been around 8 years. But still, they do not make anywhere near the money to justify, from a Wall Street standpoint, the kind of valuation that it now has. So they have to really, focus on that.
Paul, I understand you have some interesting thoughts about the culture of Facebook in terms of how the culture of the company changes once it does go public. How do you think this IPO will affect the company?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk of when you're a public company, whether you can, you know, really focus on the business or whether you start catering to the short-term demands of the shareholders. You know, I don't think much is going to change. Mark Zuckerberg has put off going public for a long, long time, and he's going to still manage the company how he wants. He still controls most of the voting power of the stock, you know, most of the stock's voting power, so it's not like he can get fired. yet, there still are demands when Wall Street is watching. So, it makes a difference, right? I mean, if the stock needs to do well over the next several months, a lot of people there are suddenly millionaires on paper. And if that does really well, if the stock does really well, a lot of them will leave and they'll start their own businesses, they'll invest in other companies, they'll just take different paths. And that's a challenge that he has to navigate.
And I assume we've seen companies in the past where that happens and people have to adjust to having lost people and that sort of thing.
Yeah, at the same time, if the stock doesn't do well, it's hard to attract people. I mean, this happened to Microsoft. It's happened at various points to Google, where you go through these ups and downs. It's just once you become a bigger company and a public company and everything's sort of out there on the table and part of your compensation with your employees is based on the stock, it just makes things that much more complicated. Presumably, Mark Zuckerberg is telling his employees this is a long-term play. This is not about, you know, catering to Wall Street, and it's just one factor. We're here for the beginning. We're not here to mark this as any kind of end.
You know, another huge thing happening in the technology world today, very opposite of Facebook, is that word is spreading that Hewlett-Packard is considering massive layoffs, maybe 30,000. And this, of course, is a company that many people think of as the quintessential Silicon Valley firm. It inspired a lot of today's high-tech entrepreneurs. Are we just to view this as the trend, the new will replace the old?
You know, the huge sprawling campus that is Facebook now was once the campus of Sun Microsystems, right? And 12 years ago, almost to the day, Sun Microsystems had a stock market valuation of $140 billion, right? I mean, this is exactly it. There's just these are new versions and new companies, and Facebook is a play on a completely different play than any of those old firms. I mean, You have never have we seen a company with 900 million, right? Almost 15% of the world's population on Facebook. We've never seen that before. And they're not making hardware yet. You know, they're not doing things. It's just like Hewlett Packard. They're not doing things like Sun Microsystems. It's just a completely different story.
It's that cycle. Paul Sloan is executive editor for the technology news site CNET. Paul, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
With the future of Afghanistan on the agenda at the NATO summit in Chicago this weekend, we want to spend a few minutes now on one incident from the war there. It's the story of a suicide bombing last month that took the life of Marine Master Sergeant Scott Pruitt, a military accountant from Mississippi. What happened to him and the other Marines he was with plays out in a dramatic series of photographs taken by Wall Street Journal reporter Michael Phillips. Phillips was riding with them when their convoy was attacked by a man with a pushcart loaded with explosives and ball bearings. You can see the photos and read Michael's story at hereandnow.org as he joins us from NPR in Washington. And Michael, you were in a town called Zarang near the border with Iran. What happened?
We were in pickup trucks, which is really unusual in Afghanistan. Of course, mostly U.S. troops go in heavily armored vehicles when they move around outside of the big bases. Because there's no U.S. presence in Zarang most of the time, they were traveling around in Afghan police vehicles, which are Ford Rangers, no armor, sort of thing you'd see on the road in the United States. There were four vehicles in that convoy. The Marines were piled in the back, in the beds or in the seats in front. And we were driving along what's called Route 9 or Highway 9 from the Iranian border into the town of Zarang. It was a commercial area. The kids were out, which is usually a good sign. People were waving. And
because if the kids are out, then you would think there wouldn't be danger. The adults would have brought them in.
Exactly. It's a classic, you know, sign of danger when the children disappear. And the kids were out. The adults were out. People were doing business. There were barbershops and stores, the normal kind of stuff. And then it happened.
A blast.
Exactly. I was sitting in the lead pickup truck in the bed, facing backwards, sitting on a toolbox, and I had my camera in my lap, and we were about, you know, 30 yards, maybe 40 yards ahead of the second pickup truck, and it just disappeared. It just was a extremely loud explosion, a column of smoke. All I could see, I remember looking back, and I could see the silhouette of the hood of that pickup truck flying through the air, and I couldn't make out anything else. And when I looked back, I just assumed that everybody in that vehicle was dead.
On the Wall Street Journal website, there's a slideshow of the aftermath of that bomber, and it plays out almost in real time as you narrate it. So presumably you were snapping photos constantly. Was that your automatic response as a photographer, even after having been so close to a bombing?
Yeah, like I said, I was sitting in the bed of the pickup truck, and I had my camera around my neck and on my lap, and I just started shooting pictures. You know, I'm really a reporter, not a photographer, but I use photos both for stories and as a reporting tool to help me remember what scenes look like sometimes. And so I just started shooting. The Marines and I jumped out of the vehicle and made our way back towards the stricken pickup truck. I shot pictures as I went, and then, you know, we all also had to deal with the casualties and that sort of thing as well. But when I wasn't doing that, I'd just take more pictures, and I remember thinking, oh my goodness, I hope these are in focus.
So you were simultaneously helping the wounded and snapping shots?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, one of the Marines who was in the bed of the vehicle, Sergeant Caleb Rauscher from New York, was thrown out. He had shrapnel wound in his side, burns on his arm, and really just got his head knocked really badly, I think probably when he landed, but I'm not sure. And so he was down on the road. Master Sergeant Pruitt, who was the most seriously wounded, mortally so, was sort of trapped inside the vehicle. And so some of the Marines were trying to get to him. Lieutenant Gabe Skanga was trying to drag Sergeant Rauscher off the street. And he was just too big to move alone. So he and I pulled him together. He was, frankly, still too big for the lieutenant and me to move on our own. Fortunately, another Marine came and did the heavy lifting with the lieutenant and pulled him all the way off to the side of the road.
One of the injured Marines, Sergeant Caleb Rauscher, plays into what, for me, was one of the most powerful parts of what you wrote, which is that you were trying to help him. He's bloody and bruised and looks stunned. He asks you what happened. You tell him what happened. A few seconds later, he says, "What happened?" You tell him again, and this keeps repeating. He couldn't retain the memory of what you were telling him. Clearly, he was very wounded, even if it wasn't immediately clear what had happened. How is he doing now?
He is back. They evacuated him pretty much immediately to a hospital in Kandahar and then moved him from there to Germany, from Germany to Bethesda Naval Hospital. And now he's in New York with his family and being treated at the VA. The military at the moment does not consider him ready yet to rejoin his unit. He has traumatic brain injury from the either from the explosion itself or from landing on the street. So he was, but in that moment, he was very confused. And as you said, he couldn't keep things in his head for more than 10 or 15 seconds. So he would ask me the same question over, is my face burned? Is everybody okay? He was very concerned about everybody else. What happened? And then he would just repeat the same questions over and over, no matter what I said. So I just kept answering the same way and hoping that it would sink in.
The Marine who was killed, as we said, is Sergeant Scott Pruitt. Would you tell us a bit about him, where he was from, and what family he leaves behind?
Master Sergeant Pruitt is from, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but Gautier, Mississippi. He is an accountant. He'd been in the Marine Corps for 19 years, was looking forward to putting in his retirement papers the week after this patrol went out. He had two little girls, a four-year-old and a nine-year-old. He was engaged to be married to another accountant who worked for the military as well. You know, he's a guy who he was very, very, very funny, very likable, a natural accountant. And he used to travel around. He used to travel around carrying a big bag of a big Ziploc bag full of candy canes to give to the kids that he'd find along the way. And the day before this all happened, we were at the governor's guest house in Zaranj, which is where the Marines were staying since they have no base there. And one of the government official's sons, who's a five-year-old, was running around his dad's office, basically. And Master Sergeant Pruitt had a box of Crayolas and a coloring book, Sesame Street characters. And he sat there in the most diligent way. The two of them sat there sharing this coloring book, you know, drawing in Elmo and I don't know who else, the other characters.
He himself was doing some of the coloring.
He himself, he did one page and the little boy named Shams did the other. And I took a picture of them and I remember stopping the little boy as he was walking away from that and asking about his picture, you know, in our non-communicative, non-overlapping language kind of way. And he showed me the picture that Master Sergeant Pruitt had done and how he'd colored it in and then he had signed it Scott and put the date on it. And the little boy was very happy with that. And, you know, 24 hours later, he was dead.
Michael Phillips is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. You can see his photos of the aftermath of a suicide bombing in Afghanistan at hereandnow.org. By the way, Marine Master Sergeant Scott Pruitt was buried at Arlington National Cemetery on May 8th. Michael, you say now you're not sure if you're remembering that day or just the photos you shot. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it was such a jolting experience. You know, the world explodes and suddenly everything is thrown into chaos. And, you know, my reaction was to take pictures and report. And some of the things that I saw in my pictures, I don't remember having seen. There's one shot of Captain Julie Hartshorn, a female Marine who dropped to her knee and was aiming. After the explosion, I probably should have mentioned this, there was an ambush and insurgents opened fire on the scene from different locations around the street. And I shot a picture of Captain Julie Hartshorn dropping to one knee and aiming back at one of the insurgent positions. In the background, you can see the badly damaged pickup truck. You can see Master Sergeant Pruitt in the front seat, just his outline. You can't see his face. I don't remember taking that picture. Obviously, I did because there it is on the camera. But to a certain extent, when you're a reporter, your notebook or your camera is a filter between you and reality. It allows you to continue doing your job even as you should probably be running for cover. I think that that it happened to such an extent in this incident that the pictures themselves are more solid than my memories of what happened. Not everything. I remember, you know, a good deal. But some of the details, really, I only noticed from the pictures.
So in the chaos of the moment, it took your photos to help you piece together how this played out.
That for me and also for the Marines. I mean, the Marines and I afterwards sat down and we went through these pictures together. And to a man, everyone said, oh, yeah, that's what happened. Or, oh, that must be me in that picture. Or that's somebody else. And oh, that's what we were doing at that moment. It really helped prompt the memories, particularly those who had traumatic brain injury, TBI, the guys who were in the vehicle itself. You know, they really had their memories prompted by these photos. They found it very therapeutic to look at them, as did I, but mostly I found them really helpful for writing a story.
Michael Phillips is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. You can see his pictures taken immediately after a suicide bombing in Afghanistan at hereandnow.org. Michael, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
As NATO leaders gather in Chicago this weekend to talk about the future of Afghanistan, there are concerns about what will happen in that country when foreign troops leave. The BBC's Andrew North reports that the transition to Afghan control of the war is already taking a toll on local businesses.
The methodical sound of the Kabul Mili boot factory earlier this year. Hundreds of workers used to cut, glue and sew combat boots here for the Afghan army under a multi-million dollar contract paid for by the US and NATO. They hailed it as one of their big success stories in buying locally and creating Afghan jobs. But now the work has stopped. The Afghan Defence Ministry has now taken over the business of buying military supplies and it's ended Kabul Mili's contract. At the factory, as they pack finished boots for storage, there are fears NATO's policy of buying Afghan first is being dropped in favour of cheaper boots from China.
If the money comes to Afghan manufacturers, it is good for the future of Afghanistan. And that means success of the country.
Fahad Safi is the director of the boot factory.
We were given a chance through the US government and we made it. We shown them that Afghanistan can make quality product.
So what do you think this says, the fact that now the contract has been taken away? What does this say about the future of Afghanistan?
Now you can see the future, what is happening. From 150 workers of the boot section, only 38 is left. In the near future, maybe in 1 or next 2 months, 38 workers will be also sent back home.
So all 150 will have
Yes, gone. And the factory will be closed.
Arguably, stopping buying boots from this factory is a sign of the Afghan government standing on its own feet, saving money before the foreign funding on which it relies starts to dry up. But there are very few large factories like this in Afghanistan. So it's not a good sign for the future if it can't keep this place open. Afghan officers organising a handout of new uniforms for their troops. But the Defence Ministry dismisses reports they'll now start buying more from abroad. Spokesman General Zahir Azimi says Afghan equipment will still be the first choice where possible.
If two different companies provide the same piece of equipment, we'll give the contract to the Afghan company, even if the quality is slightly lower.
My name is Hamidullah Farouki, and I'm a professor at the Kabul University, academic faculty.
The professor worries about how Afghanistan is going to pay, not just for its security forces as NATO starts pulling out, but for all its needs.
Our calculation says we are in great need of foreign aid for about $7 to $10 billion per year. Otherwise, very severe consequences, probably, you know, the collapse of the economy. If we get enough support from international community, probably we're gonna still have drawdown of our economic growth by 4 to 5%, and that will bring our growth rate from 9% average in past 10 years to maybe 3 to 4%.
Having been kicked out of bootmaking, the Kabul Mili factory has been left with stacks of leather and other raw materials worth millions. There's another risk, though, if the workers being laid off can't find new jobs. This man is one of the last to go from the boot factory, but he told us if he can't find new work, he's going to join the Taliban. As NATO pulls its boots out of Afghanistan, keeping Afghan boots on the ground here may be far more important than many realize.
That report from the BBC's Andrew North in Afghanistan. This week, Vermont became the first state in the nation to ban the method of underground natural gas extraction known as fracking. That's even though there are no known underground gas reserves there. Might other states follow? The Burlington Free Press reports that some officials in Michigan are interested, even though the American Petroleum Institute thinks Vermont's new anti-fracking law may be unconstitutional. Fracking is a hot topic in many parts of the country, of course. On Tuesday, the city of Loveland, Colorado, became one of the latest communities to ban it due to environmental concerns. But on Wednesday, a legislative commission in North Carolina recommended that lawmakers there vote this summer on a bill to legalize fracking. Joining us on the line is Abram Lustgarten, a reporter for ProPublica who covers fracking. Abram, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Abram, because Vermont is not believed to have any underground gas reserves, it seems like its fracking ban is largely symbolic. Do you think it sends any kind of a message or a guide to other states, or should we not read very much into it?
Well, I think it says that such a ban is possible. My personal opinion is it's unlikely to happen in too many other states. You'll see drilling activity begin in places like Illinois, North Carolina, down the eastern seaboard. But I think that the states that have resources that stand to gain from the economic benefits of exploration are going to go towards something like an all-out ban much more cautiously. It may be impractical in those places.
The American Petroleum Institute, as we mentioned, has spoken up in saying it thinks that what Vermont did is unconstitutional. Do you think that API weighed in out of concern that it could start a domino effect of other bans?
Well, I'm no constitutional expert in the law, but I find the argument incredibly ironic because for years, API's argument and the oil industry's argument has been that regulations need to be debated at the state level. That's exactly what Vermont has done in this case, and it's exactly explicitly what the API has said should happen in cases across the country.
Abram, you've also been covering in Pennsylvania legal challenges to that state's new drilling law. This is a law that critics say makes it harder for local government to regulate the oil and gas industries. That got us wondering, what kind of approval or permitting do gas companies need before they can start fracking somewhere? So can they just move right in after landowners sign over rights to them?
Well, that's dependent on what state laws allow. Pennsylvania allows oil and gas development and allows fracking. What happens at a local level is the subject of great debate and a couple of coming court fights. And as you mentioned, there's Act 13 in Pennsylvania. Court hearings will begin on June 6th to decide whether the act has removed authority from municipalities unnecessarily. A number of local governments have challenged the law. In New York State, a local municipality, Dryden, New York, challenged successfully their right to create a zoning ban against fracking. You're going to see arguments like this up and down West Virginia, Virginia, perhaps in North Carolina as well. But it's a lot more ambiguous than what Vermont has done at the state level. It's very clear that state governments have the authority to regulate how mineral resources are extracted. It's still to be decided whether that can happen at the local level.
Any other states you're keeping an eye on that you think is worth mentioning?
Well, you know, we said years ago this is a national issue, and you are seeing it emerge now in states that weren't part of the discussion. Maryland, for one, mentioned Illinois. I'm hearing that leases are being bought up quite aggressively across Illinois. I think you'll see more around the Great Lakes, more activity in Michigan. Gas prices are at historical lows right now. If they come up just a little bit, you're going to see a really aggressive push into those states and probably a few more as well.
We mentioned earlier that North Carolina lawmakers are expected to vote this summer on a bill to legalize fracking. Do you have a sense of what the outcome of that vote will be?
I don't. I was recently speaking with several officials in the state's environment office about the program, and it's interesting because North Carolina had significant geological problems with a process of underground waste injection going back several decades, and they outlawed underground waste injection at the time out of concern that fluids or contaminants could migrate underground. So again, it's a bit of a reversal or a loss of perspective that they're considering this law now. The bill that's currently on the table proposes a two-year moratorium, sort of like New York State has waded into this issue very slowly, would allow them 2 years to create an oil and gas division, which they don't currently have, and then to establish regulations that would, in their hopes, allow drilling to progress safely.
Abram Lustgarten is a reporter for ProPublica who covers fracking. Abram, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
The food policy world is puzzling over two new studies that question the connection between obesity and so-called food deserts. Those are the areas, often in poor urban neighborhoods, where affordable, healthy food is hard to find. But contrary to conventional wisdom, the latest research finds no apparent connection between the type of food being sold in a neighborhood and the rates of obesity among the people who live there. It also finds that low-income neighborhoods usually do have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. So if it's true that there's no meaningful connection between food deserts and the obesity epidemic, what should we be focusing on to help solve the obesity problem? With us to talk about this is Roland Sturm of the RAND Corporation. He was the lead author of one of these recent studies. Roland, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Roland, with this research you did, are you telling us that food deserts don't matter, or at least that the issue has been overblown?
Well, like everything, there needs to be some qualifications. I think food deserts really exist, and they're serious, but out there in rural areas. And the urban issue has been probably a little bit overstated. There definitely will be some vulnerable populations, but it might be a lot subtler than it has been displayed in the public debate.
It might be more subtle. How so?
Distance in an area where a lot of people have access to motorized transportation is very different from really being multiple hours away from any source of healthier food choices. Especially in urban areas, the density is very high, and for most people, really, availability is there, possibly a little bit further than your block, but nearby outlets do not really matter as much as people have thought. Accessibility, especially to fresh produce, has not declined over time. It has increased. But unfortunately, so has accessibility to all sorts of food, larger portion sizes, more palatable food, and relative change in prices in that sodas, soft drinks, candy, cookies. These types of foods have become relatively cheaper than less energy-dense food.
Roland, we do know that many people in low-income urban neighborhoods are fatter than their higher-income counterparts. But if that's not largely due to a lack of access to fresh produce and other healthy foods, as we've been saying it is, then what is causing them to be more fat?
There are lots of differences between populations, but I think they're minor compared to what we really care about. It's the obesity epidemic. Weight gain has been very parallel across all social demographic groups.
So everyone's getting heavier.
Exactly. Everybody, the whole population has been getting heavier everywhere across all groups. African American women, they were heavier than white women 30 years ago. Nothing has changed here, but everybody has gotten heavier. Increase in weight has been very parallel. If you look at average BMI by education, by income, by race, ethnicity. And that's why right now we're in a state where Colorado, which was considered the healthiest, is still considered one of the healthiest, is now on average, fewer people have healthy weight than they had in Mississippi 15 years ago. And so what we should be probably focusing on, what has been changing for everybody? And that is the food environment. But it's not necessarily we have so-called food deserts in urban areas. No, it's availability of food is excessive. It's very accessible, often highly palatable, but energy dense, and that affects everybody.
So do you think that we should not be focusing on individual ethnic groups or income levels?
No, if there are disadvantaged groups, there are always good reasons to pay particular attention to them. Because people living in disadvantaged areas, nothing wrong with helping them out more than people in rich areas. But we should not be misled by saying, this is what we need to do to solve the obesity epidemic. Because it's not just about minorities. It's not about disparities. That's something that affects everybody.
So if fixing the obesity problem isn't just as simple as making sure everybody has a lot of oranges and bananas around, and I don't know that anyone ever thought it was that simple, what do you think we need to do to fix it?
Much of that probably has to come with some cultural changes too. Just like smoking, it was perfectly acceptable to offer people a cigarette when they were coming to visit you, just as it's now still fine to offer them some dessert. That has changed for smoking. Definitely not normal or acceptable behavior. Politically, it's often more feasible to advocate for more. So solve obesity, provide more food, and magically people will start eating less. It's kind of a bizarre argument, but that has been the frame. It's much less attractive to advocate for less. And if you see the fire that, for example, in Newark has gotten for the advertising campaign that the New York City Health Department has made against soda pouring on the pounds, he was a policy intervention that really was focusing on let's try to reduce our excess consumption. So we had the ads in the subway, not just in the lowest income neighborhoods in New York City.
You know, you made a reference to it's common for us to want to offer food when someone comes over, often dessert. But I assume the solution here isn't just we can't be hospitable anymore, or if we do, it has to be carrots, not cookies. That seems like too small of a change to make the large-scale changes we need.
Of course. It is one of a large number of cultural changes that probably should happen. The constant snacking that had become normal, which still is not normal in other countries where obesity rates have not increased at a very similar rate. It's a whole range about relationship to food. Many things have changed in a good way more recently. The supersizing that was a trend that had been going on for decades has sort of stopped, and it's more possible to order small size portion. And that's a trend moving into the right direction.
Do you think schools have a role to play here?
Absolutely, and I think the schools have been at the forefront of changing things. Was the first area where people try to get rid of the soda in schools. Now, by itself, this won't do very much because, as we've seen in lots of data, consumption of soda or of junk food at school has always been pretty small. But there's the educational component about setting expectations, what is healthy eating and what is not in schools. The workplace is an important one, and generally the awareness. And it is changing in the population. What exists is always the intersection between demand and supply. And as long as people were not paying attention to what they eat, they were, of course, going after what's the supply, which is larger portion sizes at only slightly higher prices. This supersizing has stopped, so we see definitely a trend in the other direction.
Roland Sturm is with the RAND Corporation. He was the lead author of a recent study that questions the connection between obesity and so-called food deserts. Roland, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
For many people, this time of year is an occasion for road trips up and down the coasts, across the U.S., through Europe. For Robert Castor, it was a time to venture along one of the most ancient roads of all time, the Appian Way in Italy. Castor is a classics professor at Princeton University, and he followed the entire 353 miles of the Appian Way, which runs between Rome and southeastern Italy. What Castor saw is very different from the image of the road memorialized in the epic 1951 movie Quo Vadis. In this scene, the Roman military marches along it.
This is the Appian Way, the most famous road that leads to Rome as all roads lead to Rome. On this road march her conquering legions. Imperial Rome is the center of the empire, an undisputed master of the world.
The Appian Way helped guide the expansion of the Roman Empire, and today it winds through the vineyards, olive groves, marshes, and cypress trees of the Italian countryside. In some areas, cars honk and swerve, and others, farm animals ramble along cobblestones. As Robert Castor writes in his new book, The Appian Way, Ghost Road, Queen of Roads, no road in Europe has been so heavily traveled by so many different people over so many generations. Professor Castor, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Professor, this road has been around since ancient times. It's been called the Queen of Roads and one of the most important roads. Paint a picture for us of what it looks like.
Well, in some places, it's no longer there. In fact, for most of the area south of Rome, we can know pretty well where the road went. But the road itself is, generally speaking, either destroyed or buried under 10 feet or more of earth.
In fact, you have a picture in your book of a big overgrown field, and the caption
yes.
says, Via Appia, but you can't see any road.
Nope, all you can see is wheat, and that's probably true of upwards of 90% of the road.
But in some places, it's very urban and, as you discovered, a little dangerous.
Well, the first 2 miles of the Appian Way leading out of Rome, I would not recommend anybody try to walk unless they are very foolhardy or, as in my case, ignorant. In fact, if you go to the website that the Archaeological Service runs for the park of the Appian Way, you'll find that they very strongly dissuade people from walking on it. It's really pedestrian unfriendly. Traffic zipping by in both directions. There is no proper pedestrian walkway other than an area of pavement set off from the center area by a painted line. And the cars don't feel much obligation to observe that line.
Let's go back to the beginning and talk about when and why the Appian Way was built. Construction began in 312 BC. The road, right. as you write, was the brainchild of a mid-level politician named Appius Claudius. That's how it got its name. Mm-hmm. And he came up with this idea and imposed it on everyone, but it really wasn't entirely well received. Is that right?
No. In fact, he was harshly criticized. He was a pretty high-handed fellow, confident in himself, coming from a powerful family, and he didn't let other people's opinions deter him from what he thought was the right thing to do.
But if mostly what there had been before were footpaths, why wouldn't people embrace the idea of a direct, much more paved route down south?
Well, it was expensive, for starters. He allegedly spent down the entire treasury of Rome in order to build it, or to start it. It was built in stages. But it must have become clear very quickly that it actually was a good idea, because the road was continued beyond the point at which it finished by the time Appius Claudius was done.
You also write that this wasn't entirely a benevolent effort on Appius Claudius's part. He wasn't just out to improve society. He wanted to win some friends in high places.
He wanted to win some friends in high places and extend his patronage. Contracts would have been let for the work. And winning one of those contracts would have been a very advantageous thing for the person who won it. And they would be inclined to be grateful toward the statesman who enabled them to become better off. It's not a phenomenon that we are unfamiliar with in our own day.
And that worked out nicely for Appius Claudius.
It worked out nicely for him. It worked out nicely for his family. It worked out nicely, ultimately, for Rome.
You reminded us in the book that Romans didn't have jails, so criminals were either crucified for their crimes or they were forced to work. And the Appian Way was one of the worst places to work, in part because they constructed it in brutal heat. You say it was called a road of death.
It surely cost untellable numbers of human lives to build it. It runs through some very rugged country, crosses the Apennines, the main mountains that run down the center of Italy. And we're talking about a time, after all, when there were no explosives, there was no machinery. The only way that earth and an awful lot of rock could be dislodged and moved was by using iron picks and chisels and human muscle.
I'm talking with Robert Castor. He's author of The Appian Way. And Professor Castor, the subtitle of your book is Ghost Road, Queen of Roads. Why do you call it the Ghost Road?
Call it the Ghost Road because if you know you stand in any one place where the road still exists and just imagine the other people who would have passed by, the Roman soldiers moving south from Rome over that road, to think of small tradesmen moving south, to think of pilgrims heading toward the Holy Land in the east, all of them and many, many more would have taken that road.
Right. You write that it was used for commerce, for military, for, as you say, pilgrimages. What are some of the small details about the road that remind you of just how old it is?
I think the most striking thing about the road are the grooves left as the wheels of countless carts over countless years passed over the volcanic stone. Any place that you see a stretch of the road that still survives from antiquity, you will see these grooves. And when you consider that the grooves would have been made by wooden wheels acting on volcanic stone, it really gives pause to think how many carts had to have passed over that track to have left that impression.
There's a section in your book, and I think there's even a drawing, where you talk about how complex the engineering was. This wasn't just a bunch of rocks with dirt thrown on them.
Absolutely not. They looked at it as establishing something that would stand the test of time. And so they built very carefully in three different layers of stone, and each succeeding layer was narrower than the one on which it was set. So that there was a series of embankments that were then supported with surrounding material. It was a very, very sophisticated construction.
Professor Castor, when you talk about the Romans really wanting to build this to last, the German writer Goethe had this observation about the Romans. I quote him here, "These people built for eternity. They omitted nothing from their calculations." In that sense, how does this road reflect that spirit of the Romans, of wanting things to be very long-lasting?
The Romans had a very strong sense of history, of their own history, the history of individual families. And since, at least in the classical period, the Romans had no real conception of an individual afterlife, they believed that the only way to avoid oblivion was to establish something during your lifetime that would last and carry your name. And I would imagine that in no small part that was part of Appius Claudius's motivation for building the things that he built.
And they succeeded in doing that because this is a road that thousands of years later is still there.
There it is.
Robert Castor is a classics professor at Princeton University, and he's the author of The Appian Way, Ghost Road, Queen of Roads. Professor Castor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we leave you with the Quo Vadis suite by Miklos Roza from the 1951 movie. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Robin Young returns on Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.